Hey there, faithful ThoughtBot podcast listener. We love podcasts and having the opportunity to share our experiences through such a personal medium, and we hope you enjoy listening as much as we like creating them. For the month of December only, you can show your support for ThoughtBot and our podcast with mugs, shirts, and a limited edition knit hat. This particular shirt and mug design have never before been available outside of our own teammates and customers, and they may never be again. For the production and shipping, we are proud to partner with Social Imprints, who provides career opportunities and a living wage to people who need a second chance. So help support your favorite podcasts, provide employment opportunities for at-risk populations, and get some nifty ThoughtBot swag. Head over to thoughtbot.com/podcasts to place your order and show your support. And hey, thanks.
So I always work from home on Wednesday because I can't figure out how to book rooms, and I am always worried that the soundproof rooms are going to be taken. And they always seem to like pick Wednesday to serve the good snacks. So they just put out in the Ottawa Snacks channel, they have fried bannock and smoked salmon mousse with pickled squash and caviar and dill.
What the hell is going on over there? What's the stock price? What the hell is bannock?
I don't know, but it looks delicious. I think it's a type of fish. So Sam has been mad that I haven't been name dropping him enough. So Sam, Tess and I both caught your cold. You're a jerk. Now I've name dropped him, so he can't get mad at me.
Okay. I started a new project. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
I started a new project this week.
You started a new project?
Yeah. You want to hear about it?
Yes.
So
I was going to make a joke, but I forgot to.
It's the first project in a while that I've worked on that is totally greenfield.
Okay.
It's not
in Rails?
Yeah, in Rails.
Dude, what happened to your pledge?
That what? Oh, I mean, well, wait, hey, hold on a second. It was totally greenfield, 2 months ago.
But
it's been a ThoughtBot Greenfield project. I'm not quite sure why it's not in Elixir. I haven't really decided to bring that up yet. I think next week I'll tell them they need to rewrite it. But
cool.
So it's been interesting. It's also been a Greenfield project with a smaller company. So this morning I was commenting how it's really bizarre for me after a year of working with larger teams where it took time to get things reviewed. I can look at the Trello board, which is nice because it's not Jira, in the morning and see three, four, five cards that I'm like, oh, okay, those look like things I can do. And then be I can get all of those shipped today. I can get them done, reviewed, merged, and deployed all today. And it's just wow. I commented this morning that somebody reviewed my PR within 2 or 3 minutes of me opening it, and I just let it sit there because I was like, that's I have to wait for somebody else to look at it. That's too fast. This can't happen. Whereas on a lot of projects before, people were busy or reviews weren't very important, so they ended up hanging around for a long time. But
or nobody else in the company knows how to or wants to review the pull requests.
I don't think that was the case for the most part. I think it was
mostly referring to my crazy 3D rendering projects.
So anyway, it was cool. It's cool to be able to look at them, be we can move fast and everything's well tested and it's in a style I mostly like. It's pretty great.
Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings on that because it's nice, but it gets kind of boring.
I'll let you know. I mean, I could use boring for a little while.
Sure. I don't know. It's just everything's very easy on projects in that stage.
Yes.
The interesting challenges come from the compromises you have to make with legacy code.
I don't know. There's some interesting challenges that come. There's some interesting stuff happening in this code base. I don't know enough to really speak too much about it, but there's there's one search form that actually does several different types of searches. So there's an object that kind of aggregates the different types of searches and calls out to these various scopes or various query methods based on. So there's some pretty thought out design, but
I don't mean to imply that there's no challenges whatsoever.
Right.
Although my initial troll response there is just use Ransack. I'm aware that's why it's my troll answer. I don't know, but it's over the last year or so, I've come to have an appreciation for just legacy code. It tells an interesting story, and I kind of enjoy playing that archaeologist role.
I also enjoy that, but there's a line, right? For me, the line is, like, my experience with legacy code as a consultant is that I'm often not empowered to do as much as I would like with it. And that's probably the case with legacy code in general. Like, you're like, I'm not empowered to change this because reasons, because it's in production, because...
For me, it's backwards compatibility,
right?
Usually.
Sure, there's all of that. But there's still more that I think, more that I could do without going afoul of that. But that bit about me, generally the legacy code projects we work on are larger projects with larger teams. And there's like not as much influence as I can have as I would like. But... anyway, the one area I was starting to dig into today, like I was like, okay, I'm writing this one feature and like basically they wanted some required fields on the search form. Like right now you can click search without filling out the whole form. It's like, all right, well, these need to be required. I can just use HTML5 validation.
Yep.
And like, oh, I can't really because...
Sure you can. No, it's fine.
Mobile Safari will allow you to submit the form.
So what actually happens when they submit the form and it's empty?
It just shows no. It shows no things. So
that's fine.
That's cool. I was like, I'm still going to use these HTML5 validations and I'll note that like no errors happen. You just get no results. What do you want to do here? But then the other bit,
it seems fine.
The other bit of the ticket was like,
nobody uses iPhone.
Yeah. or the built-in Android browser, which I believe does the same thing.
That hasn't been a thing for like years. It's like Chrome
everywhere.
Now. The only device I know of that uses AOSP, which is where the Android default browser still technically exists, is the Motorola line, and even they just put Chrome on it.
All right. But then the last bit of the ticket, the last little acceptance criteria on the ticket is if the fields are not filled out, so the form is invalid, the submit button should be disabled.
So you need JavaScript.
Yeah, so I need JavaScript. And I'm like, all right, well, and it actually turns out that even though like Mobile Safari and Safari, they let you submit the form when it's invalid, the APIs for validity all exist.
Right.
So you can actually call like check validity on an input to see if it's valid in Safari. So I was like, all right, actually, this is going to be pretty easy. Like the button will just be disabled.
I mean, this seems like a use case for Ember.
Anyway, this is a long way
of
me saying
I'm in a bit of a trolly mood today.
This is a long way of me saying I started to write some JavaScript.
Sure.
And I checked out, there's not a lot of JavaScript in this file, but there's some existing JavaScript and it's all just regular vanilla ES5 JavaScript. I was like, all right, cool, we can do this. And very quickly I was like editing some existing JavaScript and being like, oh, this wouldn't pass a linter. Oh, there's no linter configured. Okay, let me look at like configuring a linter. What do I use nowadays? Do I use ESLint? That's what the kids are using, right? So let me go look into ESLint. And okay, I probably need, if I want everybody to have the same version of ESLint, I'll need yarn. So let me do this. And like, I start going down this road and I was like, why in 2016, if Rails is like this opinionated framework that's supposed to give me so much out of the box, why is JavaScript linting? Like, if you're writing JavaScript, it needs to be linted.
You haven't been following, like, the last 2 weeks, have you?
No. What? What's happening?
We do yarn by default. We're integrating Webpack.
Oh!
And we'll
You're integrating Webpack, too?
Yeah.
So the asset pipeline
I don't think we've done anything public about it. It's an ongoing discussion. Yeah, we're looking... We'll probably end up integrating Webpack pretty closely in 5.1. Right now, actually, yarn's not the default right now. You have to do --- yarn, but mm-hmm. that'll probably be the default. And if that's not the default, that'll be --- yarn as the alternative to NPM, which will be the default.
All right.
All of our JavaScript stuff is on NPM now. There was an interesting discussion because UJS recently dropped jQuery as a dependency.
Yes, I saw that.
And we were figuring out what we were going to do because just this seemed like a good time to address the distribution of UJS because our default now is put it on NPM. Which partially just means make sure it's all plain JavaScript, which is fine. But then I was like, UJS actually makes absolutely no sense on its own. So that's the one JavaScript thing that we'll have that will not be a thing on NPM. And in fact, we're going to remove it as a gem and just make it, or it might remain as its own gem, but it's going to be embedded in Action Dispatch.
Yes, it is a requirement of using Rails, basically, and it has no use outside of Rails.
Right. It's a requirement of Action Dispatch, which will just be benign if you're using Action Controller API.
Yeah. So I'm excited because I was going to be like, what is like this conversation was all going to be like, I don't understand why I'm still doing all this by hand. Are we still clinging to CoffeeScript? And it sounds like the answer is no. You're sighing.
No. So there's a decent ish chance that we'll switch to ES6 in 5.1.
Yeah. I don't care so much about the ES6 versus ES5 versus whatever. Like, I don't think you should be writing CoffeeScript anymore.
If it's not CoffeeScript, though, it's going to be ES6.
Right. It should be. It should. If it's going to be something, then fine. ES6 is fine. Something and some tooling around linting, because it's basically a requirement with JavaScript.
Right.
And as far as
make
that goes,
sure you're not using double equals.
Right. And it's like the reason why I was like, oh, we should add this is because like I opened up a JavaScript file and it was like just polluting the public namespace, which is easy to do when you're just not thinking about it. Right. And you didn't put it inside, like they didn't put the functions they declared inside of an immediately executed function. Or
sure.
Whatever.
That doesn't bother me as much.
I kind of bother. I like things to be organized and like and
no,
like,
I get like it's a best practice, but it's like I don't know. It's one of those things where it doesn't immediately stand out to me as like, oh, my God, everything's going to break like using double equals does.
Right, except that as soon as if one of those functions is kind of generically named and you do the same thing in some other file, then you have a problem.
Hi, welcome to every programming language. Have you written Ruby?
Yes, I suppose this is true.
Like, it's actually kind of, I think, a really cool feature of JavaScript that it's possible to write code that doesn't pollute a global namespace like that.
Yeah, so I'm excited that I didn't know about this. I was excited about the jQuery UJS dropping jQuery and just becoming UJS.
Rails UJS, you mean?
Rails UJS.
It was never jQuery UJS.
Yes, it was.
No, it was never called jQuery UJS. It's always been called Rails UJS.
Didn't I write a blog post about this? Yeah, I did, and it's Rails is jQuery UJS.
Hold on. I want to see this.
Yeah. Boom, require jQuery UJS is what's in your application JS file.
Ah, shit. Rails / jQuery UJS is a thing that exists.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I was excited about that going away. Now I'm super excited about the possibilities of ES6. And Webpack is like, I've always been a pretty strong defender of the asset pipeline. Like, even from the beginning when things were rough, I was like, it'll get worked out. Everybody
well,
calm down.
Webpack will integrate with the asset pipeline, to be clear.
So we're still going to get things like digesting automatically and asset path and image path and all that stuff.
And like there are legit cases for just our style of require that Webpack isn't necessarily the best for.
Like what?
I can't think of them off the top of my head. And as I was going through that sentence, I was like, shit, what's that case that Shneems told me?
So it will still integrate with the asset pipeline. It'll just be powered by Webpack.
Can we edit that to make me not sound like an idiot?
Probably not. It'll still integrate with the asset pipeline. It'll be powered by Webpack. You'll get real exports. You'll get...
Well, Webpack isn't real exports, right? Webpack is go evaluate this and remove the real exports and turn it into a single concatenated JavaScript
file. And you will get Babel?
You already get Babel.
Really?
You can get Babel today in your Rails any version by using Sprockets 4.
Okay, maybe there's not a lot of JavaScript in this project, so I might just suggest that and that we start using ES6.
Sprockets 4 is still in beta for the record at the time of this recording. It's Sprockets 4.0.0 point beta 4, but like any Rails version, you can get Babel today out of the box.
If you're willing to use the beta version of Sprockets.
Right, and if you're on Sprockets 3, I think you just require the Babel transpiler gem and it still just works out of the box. Well, not out of the box, but with that gem.
I'm just thinking off the cuff here, but this is true, right? If your assets get pre-compiled properly, Sprockets is mostly at that point done its job, right?
Yeah.
There's image path and asset path and all that stuff.
Right. So, but Sprockets does need to be aware of where in the process Webpack goes so that it can do the digesting and the minifying and the gzipping.
Yes. Okay. So there still is some stuff that it's doing at runtime. Because I was saying, like, if it's one of those...
Well, it doesn't do any of that at runtime. Sprockets, if you're pre-compiling your assets, is, like, not present at runtime, which is why it's in the assets gem group.
What's the thing? There is no assets gem group anymore.
Yeah, there is.
What? I thought they removed the assets gem group.
Did they?
Yes.
This is a thing I should probably know. Pretty sure we generate gem file with...
Rails
with
4 dropped the assets group gem file.
Well, Discourse still has an assets group.
Yeah, well, it should, because I liked the assets group.
Okay, well, anyway, it doesn't do anything at runtime.
Well, what is the part that gives you, that looks up, like if I say...
Production runtime, I should clarify.
If I say image path foo, what is
right, it? That's Sprockets, but in production, right, that's all been done. Because you were doing that in a .erb asset, presumably.
Correct.
I mean, you could do it from a controller.
Right. We actually had an interesting bug this morning where, like, somebody was, like, was trying to render an image, and, like, it was working in development, they deployed it to staging, and it wasn't working. We're like, what's going on? We noticed, like... that if you inspected the source of the image, it didn't have a digest on it. And I was like, okay, that typically happens if it can't find the image that you passed it.
Yeah, that raises in Sprockets 4.
so, well, either way, but I was like, okay, so that's the clue. It can't find it. And we're like, well, why can't it find it? It can find it in development, which is now, helpfully, as of Sprocket's something, switched to digesting in development mode. So you get digested assets in development, digested assets in production. So that's nice.
Sprocket's 3 today,
so
I think.
Why can it find it in development and not in production?
And it can't.
Well, no, it could. It turned out the reason was the URL that we were using for the image path, we were determining from a constant in a class. So my theory is what was happening was as the Rails app is booting up, that constant gets evaluated before whatever image and asset path use to look up, like, okay, they asked for foo.jpg. That's actually foo96752.jpg or whatever.
So the file did exist in app assets images?
Yes. But I think what was happening was that because it was in a constant, that constant was getting evaluated before the...
Where was this file?
It was in a it was in app models or something.
It was in app something.
Yeah, app something.
I don't think that's the case.
All right. Well, something was happening, and what we ended up doing, what the fix ended up being, was taking the constant, which wasn't really necessary anymore. It was necessary when we were like deciding, like we had some. The reason why this is in a Ruby file is like there was some logic about which image you were going to show depending on a few other things. And it turned out like we only needed one image anyway. So I was like, my first thing was like, what happens if you restart the Rails app? Because I was thinking like maybe asset pre-compilation wasn't finished before the Rails app. I'm not really sure what happened. So like, let's just restart it without deploying new code. Still didn't work. I was like, okay.
Are you sure it wasn't just like you had images slash in front of it or you forgot images slash in front of it, whichever of those two is the common mistake?
No, we checked. We tried both image path and asset path. And so ultimately what we decided to do was like just put the same exact code that we had in the controller, move it to the view and, you know, drop all the namespace we had to use to get to the helper in the
Oh, right. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that worked.
Does the controller just override that method and not use, I'll bet that's what happens.
Well, no, we were calling like action something, something helpers dot, you know, I think we're doing the right thing.
For anybody confused about what we're talking about, so the behavior of sprockets historically, when you call asset path or image path or whatever, has been go try and find this, and if it can find it, generate the URL to the asset pipeline thing, and if it can't find it, return the string that you gave it. And the reason for that was because prior to Rails 3.1, which was the introduction of the asset pipeline, people would stick things in the public folder, and the public folder is your basically dumb file server directory. So anything in the public folder gets just served if anything accesses that URL. And because the asset pipeline was not an all or nothing thing, a lot of people would do a partial transition to the asset pipeline. So this was all to make that easier. So when you asked for an asset, it would try to find it through the asset pipeline. If it couldn't, it assumed you had that file in the public directory, which was great in Rails 3.1.
Mm-hmm. There's some other uses for it, though. Continue.
But right, so as time goes on and the asset pipeline is just the thing that everybody uses, you end up with like Rails apps that are just always using the asset pipeline, and particularly you end up with like newer developers. It's not even a new developer problem, but like this is where it tends to crop up the most, where it's just like they had a typo, or the most common one was they had the image in the right place, but they were invoking the helper wrong, and were I forgot if it was either they were including images slash or they forgot images slash.
I think you include images slash, you end up getting it, but or assets slash maybe is what it is. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah. But either way, because this is combined with the fact that like sprockets, then it's also configured that when you hit a URL, it's going to try and go look in public. There's a fallback where sprockets goes tries to see if it can find it. And in this case, it can find that and then compile it on the fly, but it's disabled in production. So the end result is just it was a very common mistake that where people would have things that would work in development but fail to load in production. Mm-hmm. That got better in Rails 5.0 or 4.2, I don't remember which, where we now disable that fallback by default. And I think we actually disabled serving static files by default.
Yeah, something happened where now, I think it's part of pre-compilation in Sprockets 3, maybe. The versions, whether this is a Rails thing or Sprockets thing, is always confusing to me. But basically, even when you pre-compiled assets before, you would get both the digested version of the asset and the undigested version of the asset. And that would be part of what the bundle from pre-compilation would include, right? So if you had some place where you were writing some raw, you had a designer writing some raw HTML, or maybe you wrote some raw HTML and you just used you didn't use image path, it would still work. You just wouldn't be referencing the digested version of the asset. Then at some point, at one of those releases, what happened was they said, like, no, when you pre-compile assets, we're only going to include the digested version of those assets because that'll get rid of a whole class of problems where people are forgetting to use the helpers to get the digested version, which makes 100% sense. It's very similar
to the getting the undigested version for those. So also for those unfamiliar, the reason that we do the digested version is because caching is really hard. And you don't want people getting cached versions of your CSS or JavaScript's the big one. You definitely don't want somebody serving up the cached version of your JavaScript when the file is changed, but you don't want to set a low cache expiration because
performance.
So that's why we do the digest.
If you give each version of the file a totally unique file name, then you can tell it to cache forever. And then when the contents of that change,
So, and that file name is generated from the contents of the files.
So unfortunately, one of the casualties of this is emails, because emails live longer than a page load, right? So you might have your company logo in your email. And before, you were able to get away with saying image src equals slash assets slash logo dot png or whatever it is, right? Because those were those undigested assets were still part of what got produced when you pre-compiled assets.
I mean, you're supposed to include that as an attachment. There's still a large section, like greater than 10% of email clients that will not render that image.
Anyway, people do it.
Just say it.
And now it doesn't work because that file is no longer there. So you're like, okay, cool, I'll use the helper. But then the minute that file changes, that URL no longer works, right? Because now that file is gone. So it's almost like if you want to use the helpers in your emails, you need to have special email versions that never change. That will always be part of your deployed application so that those emails can be rendered.
Do we have a helper to include it as an attachment?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know if that's a thing.
I almost want to make it. I mean, it would be really tricky to set up properly because the place you're calling asset path or image path or whatever is in action view, not a thing that inherits from action mailer. But I would almost want to make it where if you call asset path from action mailer, it automatically includes the file as an attachment. And then links to that.
What I noticed on this project is being used to overcome some of that. I keep meaning to ask about it to see if maybe we can get rid of it, is there's a gem that people are using to overcome this with the unfortunate name of non-stupid non-digest assets or non-stupid digest assets or something like that is what it's called. And basically it says it will cause the pre-compile process to output both the non-digested and the digested version.
I mean, if you're uploading your assets to a CDN as well, you're probably not deleting your old digests.
Well, who uploads to a CDN anymore, though?
Literally everyone.
No, you have origin pull. Origin pull from your CDN. That's the way to go, man.
Oh, fine. They'll still be cached by your CDN, though, even if you're doing that.
To some extent, yes, but not a year later. That's not going
to... Get better CDN.
Anyway, assets.
That's a tricky one. I don't think that's been...
I think it's been talked about, because that's definitely a thing. Somebody created a gem for it, which on GitHub has 422 stars and 41 forks.
No, so. I'm talking about by us. I'm not sure that's been appropriately... Hold on, now I'm just checking something. Oh, wait, no, this isn't even the... Oh, right, I need to open this in a different email client, because this is... I actually don't even know if I can get the original... Wait, yes, there's a show source in Gmail. Because Gmail now, reverse proxies all... So, actually, your statement is false for people using Gmail.
Because they will reverse proxy those images.
Right, because they pull it when it comes in.
Right.
Okay, but hold on, I've got I'm in the view source. Basecamp static, and it is digested. Yeah, this URL will break if they ever change their logo.
Yeah, so don't change your logo.
Or if they change this file, rather.
Or just put the S... Oh, wait, it doesn't... You can put the assets in public and then change the configuration to, say, serve static files out of public.
Right. Or do the smarter thing, which is set up Nginx and or a CDN to reverse proxy to that directory.
Right. Yes.
That's why we turn that off by default, because nobody uses that in production, really. And, you shouldn't use that in production.
I do want to go back for a second and talk about non-stupid digest assets. I wish he didn't name it that.
Yeah, that's a really,
And reading through the README, it's the last question is, why is this not the default slash a config option in Rails 4? And the answer is, good question. I think it should be complain here. And there's a link to an issue on Sprockets Rails or something.
that's not helpful.
Yeah, I understand why people would be upset about it, but like there's a nice way to go about it and just be like, I disagree with this behavior. This gem restores the old behavior or whatever the case may be.
We have a line in Rails, which is alias method, my tests are order dependent. I'm stupid and my tests are order dependent because mini tests.
That's a mini test thing. Yep.
Like, yeah. If nothing else, I feel like that the existence of that method name is a good argument to use RSpec over mini test.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of people complain about that one. Anyway, what have you been doing this week?
So I worked on upgrading Discourse to Sprockets 4.
Oh, exciting. That's why you were saying that the Discourse has an assets group.
Yeah. Which made me learn that I don't know how Sprockets works and that Discourse does some crazy things with Sprockets.
As we learned in Richard's RailsConf talk, very few people know how Sprockets works.
Yeah. I found a decent number of bugs. I also found that Richard's been doing a really good job since he took over, and it has significantly fewer bugs than it did before that. So I'm glad, but it's definitely a project that's been in need of some TLC. But so there was that. And then just today, I got PaperTrail upgraded for Rails 5.1.
Congratulations. PaperTrail, the like thing that tracks changes?
Yeah, the soft delete gem. Yeah. Well, and then also that tracks, the give me every version that this model has ever been in gem.
Right.
Because I promised in a tweet that I would when I was asking, I was trying to get an idea of the scope of the breakage for the callbacks and dirty thing, and mm-hmm. when they were like, yeah, paper trail, it's like, oh yeah, no, I know, I'll send you guys a PR when I merge it, and then I forgot to do that.
And so you merged it, and then now you have to go do the work.
Right, well, so then, like, I got pinged in a pull request because the maintainer was like, let's constrain us to less than Rails 5.1. Sean promised to do this for us, but I think he was being over, I don't remember his words, he thought I was being too nice. We're like, no, I totally, I just forgot. And so I finally got around to doing it today, which was good because I want to do that for a couple of gems because it helps me make sure that I'm fully appreciative of like how much pain I'm causing. I actually feel a lot better about that change after having done this, but I'm also glad I did it because I realized that all of my deprecation warnings were backwards. So there's two new methods I introduced, right? For every deprecated method, there's the old behavior method and the new behavior method. And every deprecation warning recommended the new behavior method, which is wrong.
Okay, well, that's good.
So I fixed that.
Have you updated, are you still working on getting Shopify to work on Rails 5?
So we shipped that today.
Ooh.
So we had an issue. So I think we talked about this last week, right? Did we talk about the Marshall thing?
I don't know.
So we finished this a while back. And we did our first attempt. So basically for something this big, where it's like our tests are green, we call it top hatting when you like visually inspect that things work. We've top hatted as much as we can.
Top hat? That
yeah.
That must be Canadian.
Top hat made of money.
Okay.
I don't know. Anyway, we got a bunch of exceptions from a bunch of our background workers. And it was because people were marshalling instances of action controller parameters.
Mm.
And action controller parameters used to inherit from hash.
Right, no longer does.
It no longer does. This exact same issue happened for a lot of people from Rails 3.2 to Rails 4.0, where flash hash and session store both inherited from hash and stopped inheriting from hash.
Yes.
Now, an interesting thing, this is specific to things that inherit from hash and probably presumably array. And Marshall is that if Marshall gets a thing that inherited from hash and no longer inherits from hash, it blows up at a point early enough that there's literally just nothing you can do about it. And at least with the Rails 3.2 to 4.0 one, the answer was change your session key and all of your users are logged out, which isn't that bad. This one, the ones in the database were easy because you just load in the stuff like in a Rails 4.2 worker, you load in everything that you know is serialized. And then convert it to an actual hash and then reserialize it and then change your code to just work with actual hashes, which it probably already does. The ones that were in Redis, we can't just iterate over all of Redis because
right.
that would take probably months or years. Anyway, that one though, the biggest culprit there was shopping carts, which expire after 10 days. So we updated the code and then just we're going to wait it out. But then the 10 days, we do a code freeze around Black Friday, because Black Friday, Cyber Monday, we do, I think, more traffic that weekend than the rest of the year combined, although I might be wrong on that. I think our average load during that weekend is 10x our peak load the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So this year was only a week-long code freeze, which is really good. So it's funny, there's Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and then Shopify, we have Shipping Tuesday. Anyway, so that was why we didn't ship. We tried it again today. We put it on 1% of nodes. We got no exceptions. It was good. There was one dependency that we have that was emitting a deprecation warning. Deprecation warnings in production are absurdly expensive because they call a caller. So that was 1.5% of our runtime. So we rolled that back, but we'll probably deploy again tomorrow. And if there's no issues, we'll roll up to 10% of nodes and then 30 and then full.
That makes me feel good knowing that they're expensive, because I'm very obsessive about making sure there are no deprecation warnings in my code base.
I love you so much right now. I wish everybody could be like you.
Nobody wants to see those things scroll by. You want pertinent information. It's kind of the same reason I'm very obsessive about queries. Like, one extra query isn't really going to slow things down, but it's just more information in the logs when I'm looking for actual information.
Enormous number of deprecations in our tests are running purely on Rails 5. We can't fix our controller/integration tests to use keyword arguments because the keyword argument form didn't exist in Rails 4.2.
I told you when I was updating like Clearance and Scenic to work with Rails 5, I was like, this is the biggest pain. Like,
yeah. I hate it. I would have introduced like a gem. Mix-in,
yeah,
or gem. Updating our test suite is going to be a nightmare and will probably take weeks.
Yep.
Like, I'm probably going to send out a company-wide email asking everybody to pitch in on this. No, I think it's the most ridiculous, like, this is the kind of shit that leads to people just staying on old Rails versions, and it's pointless.
I think what I ended up doing in Clearance, and I'll have to look this up, is just having a helper that gets mixed into the Rails 5 version that makes the Rails 4 version not be a deprecation.
So you basically just pulled our forwards compatibility shim and then overrode the methods to call that?
I think
and then, so that way by the time, yeah, I mean, that's... I mean, like, it's better, right? Like, the old API was horrendously ambiguous and would do the wrong thing.
No doubt, this is better. This is 100% better.
I've been going through our tests. We have been finding a bunch of places where our tests are actually broken. And the code is broken because the test isn't testing what they think it's testing. But, like, I think there is a path forward that we could have and should have taken that would not have resulted in this having been a painful migration that all existing apps have to take.
Yeah, basically, I'm just looking at it right now. What I did was I have a module called HTTP method shim that defines get, put, and post, which take non-keyword arguments and then just calls super with the keyword arguments. And yeah. I mix that into controller tests.
I don't know. Maybe I need to do something about this.
But here's the thing. I'm working on a library, so I need to maintain compatibility between Rails 4 and Rails 5. You only temporarily need compatibility between Rails 4 and Rails 5. And if you keep this shim around at that point, you'll never update the test to the better API.
I don't want to update the existing test to the better API. The tests are fine.
But then how will you have new tests use the better API, which
so
we
this
would
is,
both
this
say.
This is what I want. And it'll have to be per file, right? So I can never have it be more granular than per file. But what I want to do is have some solution where existing files just continue to work. Mm-hmm. Newly generated files only have access to the new API. And I want that solution to not require like generated files have include new testing shim. Because that would never fly with
so
David.
What I'm hearing is what you want is class foo test inherits from action controller test case and then two.
Yeah. But right, the, like, but that's the other thing the new is migration that, you know, this also needs to work with like I just wrote my own test file.
Yeah.
So basically what I want is impossible without something that like runs over all existing code and just changes the class it inherits from or something. Yeah.
And even if you made it a file by file thing, like even if you took something like my HTTP shim here and you just included...
That is confusing because people are like, I'm in a different file and now nothing works the same.
Right. And now, I guess I need to include this. I need to include this shim and now everything works again. And people aren't using the new API.
It's just, I think we should have just no-docked the methods and come up with new names.
from get, put, and post.
Right, I know. I know, Derek.
HTTP okay. get, HTTP put,
I
HTTP
know,
post, I guess.
But I don't like our solution because, like, literally, hold on, let me see. I'm going to grep
you
for,
also
like,
need
lines
delete
that start
and
with
patch.
Get and then space in you, test.
Yeah. Delete, patch, all of those as well. I just don't use them, so I only pat.
Right,
only
but I'm
get,
just gonna go for
post.
Get first because get's gonna be the most common. Okay, I wrote that regex wrong. Let me try ag.
Shouldn't you be trying? What's the Rust one again?
Oh, I've got Rust grep. Ag is just an alias to RG. 8,750 calls to get.
Yeah, so you have at least 8,750 deprecations.
And like, and these are the ones where this is part of why, because we could have made that deprecation warning give you the exact code that we think that you wanted.
I looked into doing that. I spent a Friday trying to do that, and I was like, oh, this is harder than I thought.
Just enough ambiguity to make it like.
Yeah, it was like, I think I talked to you about it, and I was like, oh, you could probably get this at like the 90% case, but.
Yep. And that's the problem, right? Is that 10% that you miss, it's not necessarily going to make the test fail.
Like, I think if I remember correctly, it was like, what happens if your parameters have a key that are also the name of one of the keyword arguments or something like that? There was some sort of weirdness.
Well, I mean, one of the biggest ones, right, that makes it ambiguous is just if you're passing two hashes, we literally have no idea whether the second hash are the headers or the env hash.
Right.
Which is why the argument is called headers or env.
Right.
And like, we have a bunch of shit at Shopify, too, where we're just doing stuff that no longer works in Rails 5 in our tests, and so that's been fun. The Rails team has sort of like inadvertently become the team that people dump arbitrary technical debt on.
What do you mean by that?
People will be doing something that's deprecated and they'll get a I don't want to go on a long rant about deprecation. We're going to change act support deprecation to warn to raise in our code base is what's going to happen
in Rails.
No, in Shopify.
Okay, that's cool.
Because it's like people will submit very large pull requests that introduce new code that's relying on something deprecated that wasn't was hitting that deprecation path before. And like undeprecating it requires also refactoring their code in a way that if I were writing it in the first place, I would have preferred to have seen.
Right.
I don't know. Between that and compatibility stuff, it like a lot of stuff is getting dumped on our team that just shouldn't be, that other teams should be responsible for.
Well, that's why you have languages that have like a compiler, like a discrete compile step when you have your little IDE or whatever, and you can say like, treat compiler warnings as errors. That, and
right.
Like you say, like everybody must do this, and CI does that. But there isn't that I know
well,
of.
That's always,
I guess,
difficult. Like, it's difficult to turn that on after the fact.
I guess you could do what you were saying, which is just make the warn method raise.
Right.
In test and development or something like that.
Oh, no. We're going to make it raise in production, too.
Okay. I was going to say what you could also do is do it just on CI or something.
No.
Nah,
no,
dude. Nah,
no, because if it's blowing up our shops, then people will fix their deprecation, man.
All right. Okay. Good to know how you feel about that.
I mean, we're really, really good at responding to deploys that introduce exceptions, so it's fine.
Okay.
Raphael might disagree.
Yeah, I
he's
mean,
the
it's
boss.
On a small team, I can just pull down the latest change and be like, hey, that introduced a deprecation warning. You need to fix it. But on a big team,
right. You
can't
and
do
it's
that.
Like, I can't even, if I wanted to go look at every pull request, like I look at everything that happens in Rails, and that's difficult. I couldn't even do that for like a quarter of the traffic on Shopify core.
Mm-hmm.
But it was good. I spent today just like working on open source stuff. I've been getting into a better groove with issue triage. Because since I switched to it full time, I was always like, all right, I know issue triage takes me at least 4 hours. So I'm going to do issue triage and then lunch and then stuff. And that has led to me like not being in a great mood most of the day and like starting my days later and later and burning out earlier in the day. So
take some time off issue triage.
Yeah, well no, because that just piles up.
That's okay.
Well, but I have to still get through it.
You don't have to.
Like it doesn't go away,
but you don't have to get through it.
It's literally my job though.
Your job is to fix the ones that impact Shopify first and foremost, correct?
Kind of. Like I try not to really give Shopify hugely preferential treatment as a point of principle. But anyway, like I've just been doing a better job of spreading it throughout the day lately, and that's been, I've found, very helpful. So I'll do like an hour of issue triage and then work on fun stuff, and then do an hour of issue triage while I'm eating lunch, and then do some more fun stuff, and then do an hour or two after I'm done with the fun stuff to end the day. And it's been like, that works out nice. It still adds up to 4 hours.
So you you find that the context switch between do work, do issue triage, well, it's all work, do coding work, do issue triage work, is worth it due to the trade-off of your attitude when you're doing that issue triage or when you complete doing the issue triage?
I'm really good at context switching.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, like literally yesterday I had Diesel in one tab, Discourse in another tab, and a Rails issue in a third tab, and I was just switching between the three tabs, and then when the tests were running on one, I'd switch to another.
I do think that context switching has a cost, but I think somehow we've grown to overstate it. And there's probably all sorts of research that says I'm an idiot, and that's not true. But
I used to work in an office where my desk was between literally everybody else in the office and the kitchen. So I'm good at tuning things out, and I'm good at context switching and distractions and shit. Yep. It's a learned skill like anything else.
Makes sense.
And just, it's not a thing that most developers learn, nor is it a thing most developers should have to learn.
Right. All right. Should we wrap up?
Yeah.
Okay. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/91.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes and Google Play are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any of our other episodes, you can tweet us at @BikeShed, email us at host@BikeShed.fm, or leave a comment on our website.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.